League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
This weekend marks our first birthday, and it occurred to us that we've been rather remiss in our formative year in not having featured a music supervisor. So we decided to put that right by speaking to Sarah Bridge, who came highly recommended by one of our previous guests, the Oscar-winning John Ridley. I'm Edith Bowman, and you're listening to Soundtracking, the podcast about the sounds of the screen with directors, composers, actors, and now music supervisors. As well as collaborating with John on TV series Guerrilla, Sarah has worked on a host of critically acclaimed productions, including X Plus Y, The Sense of an Ending, and The Theory of Everything. The latter was scored by one of her idols, Johan Johansson, whose title cue from the movie is playing now. We'll hear more from him later, not to mention Max Richter, Femi Kuti, Keaton Henson and Irma Thomas. But we began by discussing what exactly Sarah's role involves. Sarah, welcome to Soundtracking. I'm really thrilled that you're here because I was saying to you two reasons. A, having another woman on to talk about music and film, but also just to explain about your role, and a role that isn't really talked about that much, the role of the music supervisor. Is that your official title?
It is, indeed, yeah.
How would you describe what your role is?
The role of the music supervisor essentially is that you oversee all elements of music on a production. So I will be involved with anything from live on-set performances and casting of musicians, being on set for the day, choosing the pieces of music, clearing them in advance of the production, coming on board at script level and working quite closely with the director to understand and develop what their vision is for the music in a project, through to coming in and post-production, sourcing composers, commissioning composers and overseeing score and helping just develop the sound.
It's a lot of jobs in there.
Yeah, it's quite a significant role and lots of elements to take on board.
I guess you can only really do one project at a time, can you?
It really depends how intensive the project is. Most roles in film tend to be quite intense, that you're on one project at a time.
Yeah.
Whereas with music supervision, it's a less full-time role. So you may come on early on and then be able to develop a certain part of it and then go into production and come back to it later in post-production. So, for example, I'm working on a new film with James Marsh at the moment, who I worked on The Theory of Everything.
Yeah.
And we did quite a lot of on-set performances, which I worked with James very closely in pre-production, was on set for them. And then I kind of stepped away for the rest of the shoot. They've just completed filming, and so I'm now going back in with him to start looking at the direction of the score, any other source or needle drop moments that we want within the film.
Your ears must have been burning about 2 months ago, actually, when we spoke to John Ridley, the director of Guerrilla, who we had a lovely time with. What a nice man he is.
He is such an
incredible
nice
man. And he was so grateful and thankful and complimentary of the work that you'd done on that show, because with that as well, it was obviously, it's a period piece, isn't it, in terms of the setting of the music.
Absolutely.
I mean, you used London-based Afrobeat bands from that period, like OC Bissa, for example.
Yeah.
but also you were really instrumental with the live element of that and the music that was played within the narrative of the production as well. So with that, I guess you've got to be right in there at the start of it, haven't you, in terms of the production meetings?
I was, and working with the very wonderful John Ridley on Gorilla was an incredible journey to go on, and probably, you know, up there in my favourite projects that I've worked on. It was, you know, each project is very unique, particularly period pieces. I'll start at script level, so I will start reading all of the scripts, understanding the time, the place, the culture, and then delving into lots of research on that project. So for example, Gorilla, my research started with going into lots of musical archives, going to Notting Hill and Brixton and speaking to record dealers, going into People's Sounds, Honest John's, talking to individuals who were part of the movement at the time.
Yeah.
You know, going into academic research on the history of black music in the UK.
That's amazing, because I think people don't appreciate the level of work that goes into it. It's not just a case of, oh yeah, I've got this on my iPod or whatever. You know, it's kind of, it's not the musical knowledge necessarily that you already have. It's about going and exploring as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think my favourite part of the project, of any project, is the research stages, when you really kind of go in and delve in, and, you know, essentially looking at cultural trends of musical immigration in the UK in the 60s and 70s for Gorilla, for example. And when I was initially looking at the early rise of Afrobeat and Afro rock, it was definitely within the UK, it struck a sonic chord with the creator and director John Ridley, and so that's something that became quite a core part of the show and then the sound of the show. During that process, they found an article from Billboard in the US that they'd written about the UK and what was happening here in the very early stages of Afro rock in the UK, which really was 69, 70, 71. And within that, found the name of a band called Noir, who were the first all-black progressive rock band in the UK at the time, and they only released one album.
Fog, tangled and thick, can't see the right road, streets are thick. The 18 mil, it might grind slow. Some quick, it has to pop. Pop, yeah, yeah. You need a rope, man, I see the time. Plays a new left, edge of mine. Catching losers, it is a line. It is a line. Cause I'm quick, it has to pop.
I couldn't find anything more than that Billboard article on them, so I set about sending it round to all of the record labels, asking everyone if they had it to delve into their archives.
Yeah.
And I very much rely on those relationships with record labels and publishers as part of my role to be able to support me in the discovery and the unearthing of artists such as them. And BMG turned up that they had the tapes in their archives, so they were then able to in turn digitise those for us.
Wow.
For us to be able to feature them in the show, which was an incredible find.
Well, John talked about that them specifically as well, and how important that you unearthed this, and you were kind of like, this has got to be, you know, this is part of the story. This is part of the journey of these people and these characters in this movement.
Yeah, it was a magical moment to find that.
You need a rope, man, a feast on a stride. It has to pop.
John was incredibly collaborative. You know, he threw me a few challenges along the way too, so he wanted all of the music to be performed and recorded live on set on the day. So normally you would pre-record, quite often in my role, I pre-record with artists in a studio and then they're miming within ears on set on the day of filming, and it's a much safer, more economical way of doing
controlled
things.
Controlled
situation. But no, John really definitely wanted to push boundaries and keep that kind of rawness and the real sound within that space, which was incredible.
Do you like the challenge?
I did. I now know how to put on gigs on a regular basis. I was pretty much putting on a gig every week and bringing in backline, and it was a new experience for me and a new challenge. And we were lucky enough to get Femi Kuti perform in the show, which was amazing.
How did you manage that?
It was part of the research. I was looking at, you know, Fela, his father was recording in London in 1971, and we were very kind of restricted to the years. So it literally was 69, 70, 71 that John wanted me to pull music from. And so Fela was in London recording an album called London Scene at the time. And I just kind of started to think about whether or not we could contact one of his sons and to see if they would be up for coming across and supporting. And so we reached out to Femi Kuti via a manager that I know who's worked with him over the years, and he was 100% keen to be involved. You know, it's politically a really important time in UK history and something that he felt very passionate about.
Did they take much persuasion then to do it and be part of the show?
No, it was kind of a timing thing, you know, and it actually worked out really well. We had him in the country for 2 days. It was an absolute delight to be around and very fun and playful and cheeky.
Yeah.
And he just really embraced it. Yeah, loved it. It was great.
When you look around us,
look around
and see for yourselves,
see for yourselves
the problems where they ground,
the problems for ground,
the problems where they ground. I say,
the problems for ground.
Politicized as well, wasn't it, really, in terms of, like, it was another way of getting ideas and thoughts across, I think, at the time.
Absolutely. And it was part of an underground movement. For example, Noir, all of their tracks are very politically led, and it's kind of part of that uprising that was happening at the time and part of the message that was coming across in the underground sounds in both Brixton and Notting Hill and across the UK and areas at that time.
You're talking there about the relationships with the record companies and kind of relying on, you know, sometimes kind of them delving into archives and things like that and trying to source stuff. Does it sometimes work the other way as well, where the record companies will kind of push stuff on you to go, oh, they hear you're working on a project to try and get you to include stuff in?
Very much so. I mean, I'm inundated.
You're plugged,
with emails
basically.
All of the time. I get hundreds of emails a week with music. So
It's
impossible, as I'm sure it is for you too, to ever sit and be able to listen to everything. But I think you have your sources that you become quite reliant on. You get to understand different catalogues and which labels have what sound. And I also work a lot with managers directly or with A&R people, a really great resource to tap into. You know, they have stuff, you know, artists very early on in development. I'm working on a project at the moment with the director of App Fab for a forthcoming feature that she's working on. And yeah, I'm speaking to quite a few A&R people at Universal Records at the moment with regards to the artists that they have that may be suitable as the film will be coming out next summer.
Amazing.
So yeah, I very much rely on those relationships.
Yeah, so
revenue
much.
Income as well now for artists.
Yeah.
You know, as records have been struggling,
it's
synchronization
nice.
Has yeah. become such a
big part. Just one last thing on Gorilla Work, Max Rister doing the score for that, who I'm a huge fan of.
Me too.
Did you have to work with Max at all? How did that kind of...
I did. I mean, every project's different. Sometimes directors, you know, I respect that it's very much a director-composer relationship and sometimes you step back and allow that to just be. And then other times, directors really want my involvement at that stage. So John did, and he wanted me to be in the spotting sessions with Max. And we would get cues in and we would discuss them together and then speak to Max on the phone about them. I'm a huge fan of Max as well.
Yeah.
He's got a lot to answer for my obsession of creating sleep playlists now. I'm like, write me a new sleep playlist every week. It was a pleasure to work with him, and he is very much in my top five of composers that I've wanted to work with over the years.
How many of your top five have you worked with?
Three now.
Whoa, yeah. That's good going.
Yeah.
It's been
a very wonderful couple of years,
yeah.
The last couple of years. Two are Carter Burwell, who I've just recently worked with on Goodbye Christopher Robin.
Fantastic.
He did a wonderful job on that project.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan. I very much a pinch yourself moment.
Can't wait to see that film.
And Johan Johansson, who I work with on The Theory of Everything. So
again,
I've been a long-standing fan of both Johan and Max's works as artists before they really kind of took off in the world of composition.
Johan, in terms of what he's done with Denis Villeneuve over the last few films, is mesmerising. And what I hear so far from the new Blade Runner film, you know, in terms of following on from that iconic score from Vangelis and having to, I guess, match it at least, it must be a massive responsibility for a composer.
Absolutely.
What was he like to work with?
He was great. He's a very calm and considered being and very humble. He really embraced The Theory of Everything. I think it was a slight move away from some of his album work. Yeah, he was wonderful, and we recorded the score at Abbey Road, which is always a delight. So he was very collaborative, and that was very much a relationship between James Marsh and Johan. We're kind of working together very closely on that score and feeding back directly. So I was less involved in the day-to-day on that.
Just watch with adoration.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, how do you get involved in a project?
Sometimes I'll approach directly if I'm really interested in a project and I read about it being in development, and I'll go directly to the producers or the director. I think a lot of the producers that I've worked with, I've gone on to work with on other projects, and so they've naturally brought me in to meet the director. The director may be meeting two or three music supervisors at that stage. I will get the script. I tend to read through the script and make lots of notes. There may be some musical cues already written into the script at that stage. I tend to walk into a meeting with a director for the first time with some musical ideas and possibly some references, but equally with a completely open mind to hearing what their vision is.
Yeah.
The role of a music supervisor is to work with a director, to be there to support them and their vision and what they want to achieve with that. And so that's very much a case of listening to the director and hearing what it is that they want to achieve.
The budget is something that always comes into discussions with the
director
in terms of when they have ideas of certain songs and it's like, that's never going to happen. I guess when you read a script and there's maybe a music cue in there, you can see the pound signs in terms of how much that specific track may well cost the production.
I guess through experience you get to have an idea of what that is. Interestingly, I worked on The Sense of an Ending, which was directed by Ritesh Batra, who's a
beautiful
wonderful
film.
Director who previously had directed Lunchbox, which was a wonderful film. The Sense of an Ending was based on a Man Booker Prize winning novel by Julian Barnes.
Yeah.
And so I read the book and then I read the script. And within the book, actually, it had written in Time Is On My Side by the Rolling Stones. And that was then rewritten into the script. And it was something that everybody felt very passionate about keeping. But as we well know, the Rolling Stones cost a huge amount of money. And I did my best.
Yeah.
I tried. I sent them the book. I sent them a letter from the director and the writer. But unfortunately, it was still out of budget. So I also, within that research, discovered that Irma Thomas had done her version in the same year. The song isn't actually written by the Stones, so we were able to license it and use Irma Thomas's version, which essentially was trying to keep as real to the book as we possibly could. And it wasn't the Stones, but we got as close as we could to it, and it's an incredible version of it.
X and Y you worked on as well. I love that film. It's an incredible, incredible film. Morgan Matthews. Is it Merle that did the original score for that?
Yeah, which is Martin Phipps did the original score for that, and he did a wonderful job. But working on X plus Y was one of my early projects, actually. And obviously working with a first-time director, Morgan Matthews, was incredible. He comes from a documentary-making background, and X plus Y was based on a documentary that he had done a few years before called Beautiful Young Mind. The film is about a young mathematician, Prodigy, who's diagnosed very early on as being on the spectrum. And it follows his journey to compete at a mathematics Olympiad. And that film, I think, ended up about kind of 50-50 score and source. And Martin worked really closely with Morgan and myself in terms of delivering that and did a wonderful job. I was reading the script, and it was actually at script level where I started to already have musical ideas very early on, and I think his voice for me was resonating with an artist that I've loved for a few years at that point, called Keaton Henson.
Love him.
Yeah, he's wonderful.
I saw him perform at Letters Live.
Oh, wow.
Which was
brilliant.
Spectacular.
Yeah, he tends to do quite small and intimate shows. I've only ever seen him in a
left field settings and things as well.
And such a powerful emotion within his voice and his performance and the fragility of his songs and his lyrics. And so very early on, Morgan had asked me to, you know, start collating music. And something that I quite often do in my role is collate music pre-shoot so that a director has music to listen to if they're still writing script notes or refining the script, but also to have on set for playback, to set moods, etc. And so I'd compiled quite a long list of music for Morgan, and he was going away for a couple of weeks, and I gave him 60 plus pieces of music initially for him to go through, and within that he was really also drawn to Keaton's music.
If you must mourn my love, mourn with the moon and the stars up above. If you must leave, leave as though fire burns under your feet. If you must speak, speak every word as though it were you.
So as we kind of continued the conversation, it became quite clear that Keaton could potentially become quite a voice within the film.
Yeah.
So we, as soon as they got into the edit and it was kind of an assembly stage, we asked Keaton to come into the edit room to meet both Morgan, but also to see some elements and watch some very early cuts of the film. And he did, and he absolutely 100% wanted to be involved within it, and I think it really resonated with him. So we ended up featuring several, I think up to about 8 pieces of music by Keaton. There's a very early on opening cue, which is across all the opening titles, which kicks in kind of a juxtaposition to what's happening in the picture at the start of the film. And he also took that piece and added some other vocals and layers and made some kind of amendments to it and adjustments to it, so it fitted beautifully to the picture and kind of heightened that moment within it. It was wonderful working with him, and really great to be able to have a voice that worked and resonated so clearly with the character of the film,
yeah.
The lead character.
Sweetheart, what have you done to us?
what have you done? And oh, please, just come here, don't fight with me.
You get into this? How did you become a music supervisor?
I went to London College of Printing and studied there, and then we studied some script writing but also music production, and it was quite a diverse course, so I kind of got a very broad overview. I knew I wanted to work in music and started in music journalism and worked at NME for a short period of time and then Uncut, a music magazine. And then I left there to do A&R at a small independent record label and publisher, which was essentially my wrong compass, developing artists. And we set up a publishing company. And then one day I found out what the role of a music supervisor was and set my mind to it. And was just like, this is incredible. I get to work with two of my favourite art forms and be able to collaborate the two together. And I've always had a kind of obsession with listening to film soundtracks and scores and classical and composers. And one of my favourite record labels has always been Bedroom Community, which has an amazing array of artists from Ben Frost to Nico Muhly to Valgeir Sigurdsson. And so, yeah, I just ended up following that path and kind of going at it and trying to, you know, it took a while. It took a lot of knocking on doors. It took trying to get some experience, and I initially started music supervision and advertising, and then I left 6 years ago at the company that was at the time to set up on my own and start working in film.
What are the films that you remember growing up and the music really resonating with you? Are there certain things either in that contemporary choices or the score element side of things, are the ones that really that you remember where you suddenly realise, God, the music is really important, or that's a great choice?
Yeah. There's so many. It's a difficult question.
Yeah, but
I think probably Goodfellas was one of the films where I was definitely not old enough to be watching it. But at the time when I did watch it, it just struck me. Like, it was, you know, I discovered the Shangri-Las watching that with their haunting song, Remember Walking in the Sand. And that just struck me, that song. And I've loved them ever since. But I think that soundtrack, for me, it was such a nostalgic soundtrack to Scorsese's, you know, 60s youth, and was just very, very powerful. And that was probably one of the earliest memories I have of, you know, watching something and being completely kind of struck by the soundtrack.
Yeah. It just sounds like such a wonderful job to be in. Like you say, it marries these two art forms that you absolutely love, and you're the musical glue. That's what I describe.
Musical glue, yes. Yeah. Exactly.
Sarah, it's an absolute pleasure chatting to you.
Thank you so much for inviting me to be on the show.
Thanks for your time. Cheers. From the soundtrack to Goodfellas, that's Remember Walking in the Sand by the Shangri-Las, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with music supervisor Sarah Bridge. My huge thanks to Sarah for taking the time to talk to us and giving us such complete insight into her many roles. You can catch up with all of our previous episodes by heading to edithbowman.com, which is also the place to subscribe to this podcast. iTunes works equally well, of course. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We're at Soundtracking UK. And do tell your friends about us if you like what you hear. Now, coming up in the next couple of weeks, we have the one and only Mr. Clint Mansell, who I spoke to at the legendary Ayr Studios. Next week, I'm absolutely thrilled to share with you director David Lowry, whose new film, A Ghost Story, is just a masterpiece. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.